Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Hopeless Romantic Podcast. After a series of thrilling technical difficulties, we are delighted to welcome Megan Durr, CEO of Less Than Three Press, to be our guest today. Hi, Megan.
Hello. You said my name right. That's always nice.
I do my best. And I realized I didn't introduce me or Amanda. So hello. As always, I'm Austin Chant.
And I'm Amanda Jean.
And this is our show. Welcome again, Megan.
Hello.
Hello. Hopefully I won't cause any more problems.
It was you the entire time.
Always me. You have no idea how much me and technology don't get along. Every time I break something, I'm just like, Sasha, fucking fix this before I break it for good.
You're always within about 10 seconds of literally grabbing the hammer and just destroying it.
I am. You have no idea.
This is not our most prepared day, but we're gonna roll on.
I brought beer.
Perfect.
I mean, that, like, honestly, after Skype put us through the ringer, beer sounds pretty good.
If I had beer, I'd probably join you. Megan is, like I said, CEO of Less Than Three Press, author of the Dance with the Devil series, the Tales of the High Court series, and I think Amanda put here approximately 5,000 other books. And we wanted to have you on to talk to us about world building, because that is a huge thing that you do very well. I'm sure wording
a huge thing.
Delightfully. That's a huge thing that you do great, Megan. I'm wording excellently today. And also about asexuality and writing ace romance and reading ace romance.
Although, weirdly, I haven't written a lot of ace romance yet.
Future plans count.
Bullying.
With no further ado, dive right on in on world building questions.
Okay.
You sound a little bit like we're leading you to your doom.
That's how I always feel when people ask me questions. I'm not very good off the cuff.
This is definitely one that I am curious about as somebody who sucks at world building. How do you start world building? Do you start with a world and develop characters to fit in, or the other way around?
I think it varies from story to story. Like, High King, I was given a prompt, and the prompt was pretty specific, so I had to build something around that. The High King, the Golden Tongue thing started because, you know, Alan was supposed to be a politician or something of some sort, and the rest of it sprang from there. But Dance with the Devil, that one also started with the character, although it actually started with Chris's parents, because I wanted to write about a ghost and a human that got together but didn't end with either somebody dying or the ghost being reincarnated, and somehow that turned into Chris. I don't know how. Then Lost Gods started with the world. I had the world long before I had the characters, so I think it just depends on what you're going for. Like, if you're working from a trope, sometimes you have the characters before the world, and other times you have an idea for how something should function. Like Prisoner, I wanted to play with magic that was induced by drugs and a country that erased people's names when they done fucked up.
How do you world build? Is it something that just sort of happens naturally in the writing process, or do you like a lot time to like, now I build the world?
I am mostly a winger. Like, I rarely plan things heavily ahead of time. Engineered Throne was an exception because I needed to do so much research on the engineers, and that kind of shaped that world. But I always assign the geography randomly and force the story to accommodate the random geography instead of building the geography around the story.
I think that was a really useful thing. I've started doing that too, because I have a fantasy novel half-plotted that I need to gut. Oh, I want, you know, these three, like, this part of the empire to look like this and have this climate. And it ended up being, like, it's like you have a house and then you add all these sloppy additions onto it. No, just make your story work, because you'll come up with more interesting stuff if you have to find clever ways around stuff. So the only things I ended up keeping was that one of them was an island and the other one had, like, a walled coastal city. And I was like, that's it. Everything else I'm just gonna use, like, a random map generator, or do that thing where you dump macaroni onto a piece of paper and then trace it.
Mostly I'm a winger. I figure out a lot of stuff as I write, and then I have to go back and change things and change more things. I'm not very good at like outlines and lots of note taking, and half the time when I bother, I lose them anyway.
That's relatable. Me for sure. That's me. I'm always like, I love outlines. I've never used one before in my life, but I'm gonna start today and it's gonna be awesome and I'm gonna follow it, and then I don't know, a week later I'm like, well, I changed everything.
Yeah, it's pointless. I once went to the pains to make a thorough fucking outline. By the second chapter, nothing worked anymore. I'm like, screw it. I'm done. I'm just too good at winging shit. I throw myself off the cliff and see where I land. Hopefully not dead.
And if you do die, me or one of your other editors will scrape your corpse off the bottom and just sort of reassemble it.
You don't have to sound so excited about that prospect, Amanda.
That's the sexiest metaphor for editing you've ever come up with.
Scraping a corpse off the ground. I don't have a folder anymore, but I used to have a folder of, like, macros and whatever that I would put into certain comments. And it is wonderful because it's a release of tension, but also I keep worrying that one day I'm going to forget who I'm editing and just say something foul in the comments. I was going to ask because I remember a long time ago I sent you an email where I was like, Megan, how do you world build? What are some of the things? And you sent me back this lovely email that was so thorough. Everything from what kind of climate to what kind of currency to what kind of religious system. I wonder, is there like a short list of stuff that you have in your head where like, okay, I need to figure this out for the story, or do you just make it up on the day?
The currency I usually forget about until I need it, and then I'm like, shit! The hardest I ever worked was at currency was tournament, because Rath had to, you know, tell how much different things would cost, and I spent like 5 hours working at the currency. I had to go back to like my books on like medieval England and figure out their currencies. I had to figure out what it would cost in today's money. I had to figure out what different foods would have cost and what they cost now. It spent me like 4 or 5 hours calculating that shit. But then like High King, I have a spreadsheet and it took me maybe an hour and bothering my wife to figure that one out. Currency and money I usually just gloss over because mostly people aren't going to remember those numbers and stuff anyway.
I think it's tempting to just be like, he paid, you know, an undisclosed amount of gold for the thing.
It cost a gold piece. Moving on.
I read Tournament of Losers last night and I noticed the part where he was like trial. Wow. Challenge where he was rattling off all the prices of stuff, and I was like, I have a feeling this took like a spreadsheet or something, at least an angry document.
Crying because I could not work out the math and I was feeling stupid. Math makes me feel very insecure. Sasha came over and helped me with it, but I needed my medieval books, I needed a spreadsheet, I needed catering websites. Like, seriously, that stupid scene took longer than most of the other chapters.
Yeah, it's basically what, like 2 paragraphs? It's not super long.
Yeah, the most frustrating world building is when you spend like 6 hours on something and it's a paragraph and then your editor tells you to get rid of it.
The stuff that you really spend the most time on, I've heard someone describe it as it should subtly imbue the work, but you don't want to draw attention to it. I'm like, no, fuck you. I just spent 8 hours devising this system of government. I'm going to talk about it.
Yeah, that's my biggest beef with a lot of mainstream fantasy is a lot of it, they seem to think that they have to add every single little bit of world building research that they did, and most people don't need 5 pages on how the economy of the kingdom works. They just need, like, a sentence, unless it's more integral to the plot.
I imagine if it were something that was really integral to the plot and also really, like, unique or funny or engaging, not just like, this is all the work I did, and here's a pile of exposition.
You can say more with world building with, like, how they cuss than 6 paragraphs on, you know, their system of trade. Rather or less historical, it would be a Western, so I'd have to know all of that anyway. I have a lot of books on the Wild West. Haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, I've read a lot of Westerns, and I have some research already collected. I was going to write the originally my Bounty Hunter story was going to be set in a version of a real ghost town in California in the Sierra Nevadas, Bodie. And I was like, oh, I really like this, and I did so much research on this town. Holy shit, I did so much research on this town. And then I realized that it wasn't really necessary to set it there.
Yeah. 12 hours researching something, then realize it's not gonna work, and you have to research something else.
A question that I was really interested in, which kind of connects to that, is like, what is the most fun genre to build in? And that made me think of that because those little things are so telling of, like, are you writing fantasy or are you writing sci-fi? And if you are writing fantasy, is it urban fantasy or historical and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I like a high fantasy. I like to do all of the work. I'm not very good at historical. Historical is, like, the worst parts of fan fiction and the worst parts of fantasy. Like, I admire the people who do really good historical fantasy because you've got to get all the historical detail right, then you have to make up all of the fantasy stuff, and there's, like, no leeway. Especially with historical writers, man. They get fucking if you get something wrong.
And you also run the risk if you do enough fantasy world building of potentially invalidating something historically significant. People get upset about that, understandably in some cases. I'm thinking about the fantasy that I read. I don't read a ton of historical fantasy. I usually read high or like mid. I do like historical fantasy if it's done well, but It is tricky.
So do I. I've just been reading, not M or queer fantasy, but the Jacoby series. I think it counts as lit or YA. I'm not sure which. But that's really good historical fantasy. It's cute. It's like a Sherlock Holmes sort of thing.
That sounds super intriguing.
They're really, really fun. The first book is good. The second book is better. The third book is amazing. The fourth book doesn't come out till August.
Oh, no. Agony.
Life is pain.
It is. All of the books I want right now don't come until August or September. I'm like, are you shitting me?
You're like, what do I have to read in the meantime? Although you have 8 billion books in any given time.
I do. It's kind of a disease. I just, like, compulsively buy them. I've been trying to make more of an effort to actually read them instead of just hoarding them like some sort of sad dragon.
I've been doing the same thing. Like, I'm usually pretty good about not buying a ton, but for some reason, I don't know if it's, like, a stress response, but I've been buying books like fucking crazy lately. And my Kindle went from, like, 10 to, I don't know, 50, and now I'm just sitting there like, I gotta read these.
Too long to whittle down my Kindle. I had like 300 books on that fucker, and it took me 2 years to finally get them down to like, I have 4.
Wow. I don't know what that would be like.
Especially because I know how much you work on top of everything else.
And
so.
I judge for the Rainbow Awards, and I judge for, it's really cute little contest for like middle school and high schoolers. They write like essays and poems and like short stories. The poems are always like so super emo. That's awesome.
It's so earnest when they're that age, though. There's not much hint of, I don't know, I guess there's pretension, but it's certainly earnest pretension. I'm kind of afraid, like, I spent most of my teenage years writing fan fiction, but I'm kind of afraid that if I looked into my files, I would find just horrifying parodies of teenagehood. When I was a teenager, I literally sat down to write this epic that was about the devil and his gay boyfriend. And so I had, like, this weird, like, mythical, like, the battle between the angels and demon shit, but also the contemporary version where occasionally they go to BDSM clubs. So I'm real proud of like my 15-year-old self for whatever that was.
Well, that's way more exciting. My 15-year-old self just like describes stuff. I have journals just filled with me trying to describe things. I still suck at description, by the way.
No, you don't. Although I will say, I was laughing when you were tweeting about most people tell you to cut out your meal descriptions, and I was like, where is it? I know you want it. Where is it?
I know. I was trying to make it for once, and you tell me to put it in there. I'm like, I hate you. When people yell at me for food again, Amanda, I'm forwarding you all the email.
we'll just make sure that it's there, but it's unobtrusive.
It's all medieval food, and I try to go with some of the weirder things, so.
Nice. So, if you're reading, let's say it's fantasy, it could be even just, like, low paranormal stuff. What are the elements that you notice people skip in their world building, or they at least skimp on?
I was gonna ask that too, because I feel like weird medieval food is one of those things.
That's an interesting question. I think people don't think things through enough. Like, still think of a neat, like, I see a lot of slavery stuff, which is fine, but like, they'll have like a temple of sex slaves, and you know, the king invariably falls in love with one of them, but they never show how all of that affects the whole rest of the culture, or everybody's just okay with it. Or like Tavamara, I wrote because I read so many harem fics and concubine fics where homosexuality is bad in the kingdom, and the king has like 10 wives and 20 concubines, and all of a sudden he decides that this dude who sneaks into his room is going to join the concubines, but nobody gets mad that he's suddenly banging a dude even though that's illegal, and they don't care that there's one guy in a harem of entirely women. They think of like A, but they don't think of B, C, and D, if that makes any sense. So if you look too hard, things start to fall apart.
Yeah, even, I feel like even paying lip service to it, oh yes, and then the protests, the attempts, like the newspaper articles questioning your fitness to rule, or like people trying to assassinate you and take the throne have risen like tenfold since you took a male concubine.
Or they don't like research how, like kings, even something like kings and queens would act, and there's always room for flexibility, but I've read one story where the king just went for a walk, just left the castle, went into the forest, and I'm like, there's no way somebody would just let the king walk out of the castle for like a peaceful walk through the glade.
At the very least, the king would have to do his best to sneak out. There would be guards and guards and guards involve planning it, making sure the entire hanger-on or crew went with. It's like, let's make a day of it, because there is literally no other option.
I feel like it's that those kinds of missing details that start to make it feel less like a real world and more like kind of a skin over the world. Here's a king. What a good idea, a king. And then it doesn't really go deeper than that. it doesn't go into the material reality of that situation.
Or going back to food, there was a story once. It was medieval, castle, kings, knights, eating fried chicken.
And I'm guessing it wasn't, like, purposefully anachronistic.
Didn't think about it. They're like, what's a good food that's been around a while? And I mean, fried chicken's not wrong per se, but it didn't originate in medieval England.
I feel like if you were going to stick it in there, like, you would maybe want to call it something else, just so it doesn't have that more... It's got a very specific connotation.
It does. Like, it's completely different settings and issues. Yeah.
A chicken boiled in oil.
Yeah, chicken browned in oil until its skin, like, which had been coated. Just find some way.
I feel like the only acceptable way to do that is if your readers, like, read it over a couple times and then tilt their heads and go, you mean fried chicken?
I do something like that with a carrot cake once. I don't remember what book it was, but he's like, they found some root vegetables. Like, I can make a cake out of this if I have, like, such and such. I'm like, you're making a fucking carrot cake.
What kind of frosting does it have?
They're like, if there's no cream cheese frosting, I'm not eating that.
It does remind me, though, sometimes one of the mistakes I see in world building, especially for fantasy and sci-fi, are unnecessarily complex or three steps removed descriptions or names of things that exist. Like, glasses get named something weird and, like, they give it a nice little sprinkle of fantasy dust on top of it. And it's like, you could call them reading glasses, you could call them spectacles, like, just find something. Because after a while, it's like, the sight goggles.
Yeah, that pops up a lot in steampunk, I think, oddly enough. Like, sometimes I can see where you want to, like, find a different term, but other times it's just like, just call them glasses. If you're gonna start using weird phrases for things, you gotta stick to it. It's usually not worth the effort.
I read steampunk where I literally had no idea what was happening until the end because they did not contextually define what one of the key things was, and I was like, are they on a ship? Are they on a boat? Are they in space? What's going on here?
The story has to be readable. Like, High King, they actually speak a pretty freaking ornate language. It's got a lot more in common with, like, Chinese than anything else, but if I belabored conveying that, the story would literally be unreadable, so I stick with keeping the language simple and just expressing how it would actually sound, which is the most readable compromise I could come up with.
A lot of authors, especially new authors, don't realize that dialogue is not supposed to be an exact expression of how people talk. It's supposed to communicate something and express characterization and move along the plot and be as, like, snappy and concise as possible.
Yep, I bought one story. The dialogue, the jargon and stuff was just so heavy. The story was highly lauded, but I couldn't read it. They spent so much time making the language unique and different that it was unreadable.
I see that you put so much time and effort into this, but you've just made it an obstacle for your readers to connect with your book. I find the same thing about dialogue or speech that's written in too particular a voice, like, especially if someone has an accent. It's like the Hagrid thing. Like, don't phoneticize someone's speech unless you absolutely have to.
One of the most important rules I learned in writing, actually, from, like, the one writing class in college that I took. It was, if you're going to give somebody an accent, use it in, like, the first few pages of the first chapter, depending on the length of the book, and then stop. Because at that point, they will hear that character in that voice. You don't have to keep, you know, doing the accent. You can literally just stop doing it, and they will still hear it. So if you do that through the whole book, it starts to really get hard to read, especially when it's something like stuttering, which is a good thing to include. But if you keep over stuttering the character, it gets hard to read. But if you do it, like, the first chapter, they'll keep hearing that stutter through the whole book.
Another note I would put, because I've noticed this a couple times, is they assume that stuttering is kind of random, and they don't look up that there are patterns just to stuttering, and they differ for some people. So stuff like that, if you're not overly familiar, let's say it's not even a stutter, but, like, a particular accent, you need to study very closely. Like, for example, in Southern accents, like, some people will drop the G and some people won't. Regionally, there's different expressions, so you need to make sure you have that.
People from the Carolinas speak differently than people from Georgia, from Mississippi, from Texas.
It's so regionally different. Like, I don't think people realize how large the South is, but whatever. That's
kind of a big, big area.
It is. My mom is from North Carolina. She doesn't sound like anybody who's from Georgia, and people that live in the South can tell which state you're from your accent, whereas once you go North, everybody thinks all Southern people sound the same and stupid.
It's like, generally, like, it's either, like, some guesses to either, like, an Arkansas type accent or even Louisiana, and it's strange because that's two accents out of probably 50. I noticed the things that I do as sort of a cheat sheet is sometimes I'm sitting down and plotting something for the Fool for You call right now. I really need to start that goddamn book. It's like due in a month. Whoops. Great at time management.
This is a call out to Megan and also to our audience. Join me in bullying Amanda into writing this book.
I'm trying. I'm trying.
And I'm going to ask Samantha if I can edit it. Revenge, bitch.
Revenge. Good. I need you to rip it to... I'm having problems with it. But so I sat down and I was like, well, I need to world build these countries that these characters are from. And I kind of, like, I didn't want to dive into nothing from that. So I was like, well, I can sort of at least initially base them off of England, France, and Spain in, like, the 1600s. And then that ended up, how closely do you follow that, right? Like, am I going to take the language of those three? Am I going to take the culture of those three, the religion of those three? And that's one of the cool things about world building is, like, you can take, I mean, within reason, you don't want to completely yank something out with context.
Oh, you will do something, like, horribly racist, but like like, Lost Gods, those are all pretty obvious where I drew, what countries each one I drew from, the Russia, Spain, France, but High King is based... its basis is medieval India, but you probably can't really tell that much.
Yeah, that's the thing, is, like, I think that it's important to have springboards to at least give you an idea of, like, oh, okay, these are how these countries differ, so how do I extrapolate that in terms of a fantasy world? Because if I kept the idea that these are based off of England, France, and Spain, I would probably show that in my writing, and I don't necessarily want to. Like, I don't want people to read it and go, oh, it's England, France, and Spain. Great job, Amanda. Great world building.
But it does help to have that starting point, because then you automatically, you have a basis for what the climate would be like, what the clothes might be like, so far as, like, fabrics go, or what foods are there, like, would they be more likely to drink wine or beer or none of those?
I actually have a question from, somebody on Twitter who asked, I know that the High Court series isn't based on European feudalism, so I was wondering where you got the influence for that, although you did kind of just answer that question. And what kind of research and planning goes into a setting like that and the Tavamara? Is it Tavamara or Tavamera?
Tavamara. Although I really don't care if people say it the way they want to say it. It's fantasy. Who are you going to offend? But yeah, High King's basis is very loosely medieval India. And let me tell you, the weirdest thing I've ever had to look up to right now is it was actually for the freebie where Serica met Niall. I had to research what the hell did they eat as camp food in medieval India at war. It took me 2 hours and whining to Kirby Crow to figure out what they ate. Yeah, there's other elements pulled in, because above all things, the High Court is supposed to be a very international place. So yes, the basis is medieval India, but there's all kinds of other influences. The clothes are equal parts, like India, Chinese, with a little bit of Western elements in there that actually come from Treyamensi, although I've never spelled that out. The same way, like, countries all around the world wear Western suits, even though they might not wear that in day-to-day, it's kind of expected that, you know, when you do business dealings, you have to wear a fucking three-piece suit. Treyamensi's pretty influential, even if they're, you know, the bad guys. So a lot of clothes carry their influence. I hate info dumping. I fucking hate it. I've given up on most mainstream fantasy because the books are 1,000 pages long and 500 of them aren't necessary. But I'm also a minimalist writer by nature, so that's why I'm having to double the length of my story, Amanda.
Look, you told me, you were like, this probably needs to be longer, and I was like, yeah, it does.
That was exactly what I wanted. No, I'm a minimalist writer by nature, so where everybody else usually writes too much and has to nix stuff, I usually err on the side of too little and wind up having to add stuff. In Despair, started at 40,000, I deleted 20,000, added another 40,000 back in.
I'm like an overwriter to start with, but then I cut too much. And have to put more back in.
You just have to commit both sins before you get there.
One of the things that I noticed is, like, if I edit fantasy, there's always a scene, I don't know why, where someone sits down and is like, I'm going to tell you the myth of my people. And I'm like, I don't want to read five paragraphs or more of you recounting a myth with absolutely no dialogue. Like, there's no action. There's no, you know, there's no back and forth. It's just, I'm going to give you a 5 or 6 paragraph block of a myth retelling. It's like, there's got to be a better way to do this. I would rather read that as an italicized prologue. Like,
it's actually funny. Out of the Lost Star, my beta wanted me to add more of Jado telling legends and stories of his island. So there's like 2 scenes where he just tells some sort of legend of his island. So you're not gonna like this part, Amanda.
Amanda's ready to fight.
I'm always ready to fight. It's like there's a certain amount that I allow because especially I don't know. Sometimes with reads like filler or info dump to me might actually be necessary for like a second book or whatever. But even then, if it pings the sense that it might be info dump, it usually is. Like if it's exposition-y or it's literally like, I look into this mirror and I think about my childhood and this one thing that won't come up again later at all.
You should tell them something's going to be important far down the road, and when it's just info dumping.
I'm trying to think of what else. Sci-fi's really, I've seen so much info dump and exposition in sci-fi, especially like if they figured out a mechanism of how something works, like in terms of technology, they're like, I'm going to tell you all the fuck about it.
I hated sci-fi for years because I just didn't fucking care how the transporter works.
Every time it's like, hey, did you know that in this world, space travel is fueled by these inventions and blah da 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 da. And it's like, I'm interested in that if that's part of the story in any meaningful way. I'm not interested in your short story where it begins with 50 pages of that and then the plot is something different. If you're going to tell me a story about the person who invented that system, sure, let's go in. Let's go all in on that. Just otherwise, it's a spaceship. I know it flies in space.
Right, most people just don't want the mechanics. They want to know when it's going to blow up and how that leads to, like, the captain and his prisoner making out, let's be honest.
Especially if we're talking romance, like, some of the subgenres get extra leeway for sort of info dumping or extraneous information because it's color, like fantasy color or sci-fi color or whatever. And, like, that's cool because you can do some really interesting stuff and you can do a lot of, like, allegory and commentary like that in a heightened way that you can't necessarily do in contemporary. But then it's like, come on, man, I didn't sign up to read this romance novel about kissing aliens and you just told me about, like, how they're food replicator works. Like, I just want to know that it works.
Right? There's a food replicator, that's all we need. Or maybe it's important that it's broken, fine.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of the hardest distinctions for people to learn to make is between good writing and important to have in the book.
Yep. Especially when you spend hours doing research, you're like, well, I want to include this. It might be important. Yeah, it's probably not.
I mean, for Peter Darling, I literally checked out a stack of, like, 8 books from the library to do research on the historical context of trans people in 1920 and who all of the, like, relevant thinkers were and, like, read first-person accounts of blah-da-da, and then realized that not a single scene would reference any single piece of research I did for the book.
Yep.
Well, it gave you an idea of the mindset of the time. Like, that imbued the story.
Yeah, but, you know... I was like, part of the story surely will take place in a world where any of this will be relevant. No.
Nope. Yeah, we took that the fuck out.
I took that out before I even sent it to you.
I know, but I say the royal we because I had to hear about it. I don't know how much you know about this, but he was originally going to write something else for MDE and had that plotted out and was like pitching me like, what do you think of this and this? And I was like, yeah, that all sounds good. And then after he had started to script it and was getting to write it, it just wasn't working.
It was not Enemies to Lovers, and I kept trying to make it Enemies to Lovers, and it just wouldn't go.
No, you need to be this, and the story won't, and everybody's unhappy.
Why won't you antagonize?
But he came home one day, and he was like, what about a Peter Pan hook pan thing? And I was like, yeah. And then I watched him literally tear his own hair out for the next several months during writing, during editing. Somewhere on my phone, there's a picture of, like, right before the final deadline. I came into your room and you were just, like, wrapped up in a blanket on your chair in the middle of the room, like, just like,
There was the one where you came in and I was lying on the floor.
Occasionally, I would just knock and be like, how you doing, buddy? How's it going? And then I got stressed out about deadlines, too. It was a wonderful feedback loop of getting to see firsthand what my edits do to people. I was like, oh god, this is awful. I'm sorry.
And to be fair, half of that I was doing to myself, you know? Yeah, we wanted to ask, first and foremost, what your fave book recs would be for Ace Romance.
Oh lord, that might take me a minute. I read so many books. I'm really fond of The Galloway Road. I thought that one was really sweet and fun, and it was also spooky, which is rare. Most of my favorites are from LT3, which probably makes me heavily biased. I love Break Fire's Glass. That story, if there was any story I resonated with, it's Katerini in Break Fire's Glass. She's awesome because she's violent and emotional, and people always think she's an evil bitch, and she's not, and I feel that. But also Anne Valenza does beautiful writing. Of course, I like My Wife's, because I got to see that that one, as she wrote it, How Not to Summon Your True Love.
Oh, yes. Mm. That one's so cute. It's so cute.
I also like Lone Star and a Cowboy Heart. That one is really fun. It doesn't get a lot of attention, but I like it because the one guy is heterosexual and biromantic, and the other guy is Ace and Arrow, and there's never a huge issue or drama or misunderstandings or trying to convert. They're just happy the way they are. I really get tired of reading Ace stories because it's like the way M can be sometimes. It always has to be about them being gay or like about them being trans. I like it when it's incidental, not 100% the focus of the book. Peter Darling was a nice balance. I really thought all of those elements integrated without, you know, like so many other people would have written the story just about him being trans, and I feel it would have lost all the other awesome elements.
I feel like it's important for us to talk about, you know, experience of being ace and trans and all that, but it's like when you can't tell any other story for that totally eclipsing everything else in their lives, they just, you just lose so much potential for hijinks and adventure and anything else other than like queer misery.
And you would feel this more than me because there's so many trans books that are not written by trans people that are about being trans, and at least the Ace ones like that just drive me up the wall because they explain Ace poorly. Ace is always in the title.
My version of what, you know, my lived experience as Ace is different from somebody else's, and it's also different in a fictional context. It's going to be expressed differently because it's not someone's lived experience. They're not real. So it's like, you can do some interesting stuff. You can take some liberties, but like, come on, you have to fundamentally understand at least the ends of the Ace spectrum and be like, okay, so this is what this looks like. And I've read blogs and firsthand accounts and books by Ace authors to try and put myself in that mindset. And it's not just like, it's not 100% of the time a complete lack of sex drive or sexual attraction. Like, it varies from person to person. And I still have my poor unfortunate Ace Bounty Hunter story that I need to finish.
God damn. Do you finish anything of Endo?
Yes.
Other than Hannibal fiction.
Although I should say I haven't written I haven't published anything in like any fic or anything in like a year and a half or something. I've been busy. But I wanna finish the Fool for You thing, or at least get a draft out, because also, I'm really excited for the Written in the Stars call, because I don't think people understand how badly I need alien fucking.
I feel like you should take a moment to introduce what that is, Amanda.
Just alien fucking, or no.
Written in the Stars, you fool.
So I don't know that it'll be, I don't know when the call goes up, but not right now.
Probably April or May or something, because of course Amanda just needs a breather before we get more stories dumped on us.
So as a prelude, pre-call, THR listeners will find out that we're going to be putting up a call for short stories and novellas. It's minimum 20K, maximum 60K, about human-alien relationships. Look, I'm going to be honest and say that it is purely to pander to mostly me and Megan and Sam.
For the 50% of people who answered yes on the poll that I did on my Twitter, would you read a romance about a human and an alien trying to eat them?
And they were like, yeah, I would. And I was like, yeah, I would.
There's very little I won't read, usually to my deep regret.
I don't know if it's just the years that I've spent on the internet reading every piece of filth that floated by my field of vision, but I don't even know where that desire for monster and alien stories came from. Like, it just seemed to appear one day fully formed.
Anything that's anthro or something, I'm there for. It's just a very small following. I can never find everything that's available, I think I've read. You sound too controlling and too intent on messing with your own work to get shit done, Amanda.
So one of the questions that we had from someone on Twitter, which was curious about the range of books that LT3 accepts, because your range of romance subgenres is astounding. Is there a genre that is more likely at LT3 to be accepted over another? Like, do we have a glut of stories of one particular type and we need other genres sort of filled in?
Likely to reject a story on genre. We get a lot of, I wrote a story about growing up gay in the 60s or 70s, and we don't think we're a good fit for those most of the time, so we're not likely to accept those. And we seem to be a good haven for like fantasy and sci-fi and stuff. We don't get as much contemporary as like say Dream Spinner and Riptide and all of them do. I mean, if you're intent on being a hardcore contemporary writer, you might be better off somewhere else, but we accept everything, and we do pretty okay with everything. We get a lot of YA, and we're not a YA press.
Which, thank goodness, because people keep tagging Peter Darling as YA on Goodreads, and the one thing that makes me feel better is that LT3 doesn't even publish YA.
And so as an extension of that question, is there something you're looking for in particular for Ace and Arrow stories at LT3? Like, is there something that you really want as both a reader and the CEO?
Well, I always like fantasy stories. I don't read a lot of contemporary, and I don't... One of my biggest beefs with fantasy is that almost every story I try to read... It is like, you know, so-and-so is prince of this country, and he's in love with so-and-so, but homosexuality is illegal. And I'm so tired of people writing fantasy stories where things like homosexuality and all are illegal or frowned upon, when it's so not hard to make those part of the culture, to make them incidental and accepted. I mean, Tournament of Losers, there's trans characters, there's genderqueer characters, none of that was hard to insert. Same thing with High King. So I would like to see more stories with Ace characters and demisexual characters and trans characters who are purely incidental.
I've heard a lot of discussions about, like, why would you write, like, a system of racism into your books? And it's the same thing. Like, why would you write homophobia and transphobia and even, like, misogyny into your books when you don't have to? Like, you control the world. You don't have to base it on, you know, actual history or whatever. You can invent something entirely new. And especially for something like romance, which for, you know, it's meant to have happily ever after or happily for now. And that can be bent a little bit, but it's kind of hard to have that gratifying feeling when it's like, also, people are horribly mistreated in this series.
Yeah, I feel like you get further getting people to change their minds and see the world in new ways when you show it positively. If you just write 10 stories about how, you know, queer is bad, then I think on some level people are always going to believe that queer is bad. But if you read 20 stories where it's just accepted and not a big thing, then people will start to think that way too.
It's hard to see people as fully human and happy and worthy of, you know, a full human, happy, loving existence if stories are about them being constantly marginalized and
other
abused.
They're always going to be seen as other. And I mean, don't get me wrong, stories, all stories have their place. It's important to have stories about being asexual, but I also think that stories where the asexuality is completely incidental are equally important.
It's twofold for me, because, like, I want those stories as a person who wants to have, like, frankly, that escapism. I just want to have that happy story about a part of me that doesn't necessarily feel happy in contemporary times. But also, you know, if somebody's never read an Ace story before and they pick it up, like, I would rather they read a story about a happy ever after for an Ace character where it's not a problem versus something where it's belabored that they don't, you know, they aren't accepted or they're othered or they're miserable. Don't want people's first impression of asexuality or being genderqueer or whatever it is to just be like, they're miserable and tormented. No, thank you.
Like I said, Anne Bolenza writes really good Ace stuff. Her story, Into the Hollowed Veil, because the one guy is completely, totally sex repulsed asexual, and the other woman is a sex positive asexual, and they mesh very well with the allosexual guy. I don't know. I love Into the Hollowed Veil. That story is beautiful.
Also, I love that there's more than one example of an Ace person, and like I was saying, like, the spectrum of individual Ace experience is so different. And Arrow, too. Like, that was one of the things. I'm happy that Arrow's starting to get a little bit more rep at different presses, mostly LT3. If anyone wants to continue the conversation on Twitter, I am at Amanda H. Jean.
I'm at Austin Chanted.
And Megan, what are you at?
Megan Ader.
Thank you so much, Megan. See you next time, everybody. That's our show.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Daria DeFora and Amanda Jean, with art by Keezy Young and music by Carly Ann Warden. If you want to continue the conversation, follow us on Twitter at TheHRPodcast, follow us on Facebook, check out our Patreon, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.